Hello, I'm Rhianna Patrick and welcome to Away. Thanks for joining me on my first foray onto the airwaves at RN. I'd also like to say thanks and farewell to Daniel Browning, who's taking extended leave and has passed the Away baton on to me. In fact, passing on the baton is at the heart of today's program. In this case, from one generation of Indigenous artists to another.
I have great non-Aboriginal friends who are curators that always have an Aboriginal person in their show, but it's not to tick a box, it's not tokenistic. It's because the belief that how can you curate a show under any premise within an Australian context without having an Aboriginal person in it.
Yeah, it would always be called Black Seas and stuff. So I thought, I'll take the sea out of black, and that's why it's B-L-A-K. The idea of B-L-A-K also was to do with about colonialism and to do with about how we can express ourselves as urban people that have put up with that kind of system, and we are sort of political, and we've got something to say, and we also love where we come from and have family and have networks and stuff.
We didn't just open the doors, you know, for these youngsters to come through, you know. We kicked them off the fucking hinges. there's no doors there now. You know, people can get picked into these shows now. And I was so surprised, you know, pleasantly surprised, you know, to see this this thing eventuate, you know, it evolved behind my back, basically.
Next Wave Festival 2014's keynote initiative this year was Black Wave, a program of exhibition, talks and a book which explore the political, personal and aesthetic boundaries of contemporary Indigenous art. Away went along to record the keynote discussion last week, and it's a funny, frank and thoughtful exchange between young and older artists and curators. You'll hear young curator Taji Moore, Tony Albert, and fellow artists Destiny Deacon, Virginia Fraser, Clinton Nain, and host Richard Bell speak frankly on what it means to be a 21st century Indigenous art practitioner and how their artistic practices are helping to forge a fresh path to the future. But I'll hand you over to an elder of the Wurundjeri Nation, Auntie Diane Kerr, to welcome us to country. And a little warning, there's some strong language in this program.
Hello, everyone.
Hello.
Thank you. I'd like to pay my respects to my elders past and present, elders present here today, elders of different nations that are here today. I'm here on behalf of myself being a Wurundjeri person, but also for the Bunmurrung. We share this area and we work together to bring unity amongst people and amongst our community in Melbourne, helping people heal so that we can all walk together on one path. Tonight is a special night, thinking about country and art and healing and music and dance to country. And it's very important that we tell our stories, particularly in our art. And it's a personal story from everyone. And, you know, when we tell our stories, we give a piece of ourselves away. And everything that we do is from the heart. So while you're here, I'd like to ask each and everyone to talk to each other and share a bit about where you come from and who you are. The reason I ask that is because I firmly believe if we can understand each other, we can live in harmony. And when we do that, we eradicate racism and stigma. And when we do that as adults, it's our children that live in peace. And I know we all want that. We want our children and our up-and-coming future leaders to live in peace and harmony. May Bunjil, our creator, surround you and keep you safe on country. On behalf of my elders, I say Wiminjika, Wurundjeri Bunurong, Balak Yim and Gundibik, which means welcome to our home. So please, Wiminjika, welcome.
So, as we've said, Black Wave is a program that stretches across three mediums. It is a book, it is a talk series, and it is seven new contemporary art projects. And I'm incredibly proud to present these ambitious, significant new works, often in mediums that represent new areas of the artist's practice. So we're talking about really talented artists such as Stephen Payton, Megan Cope, Carly Shepherd, Genoa Gaylor, Colin Kinchler with Gavin Walters, Ryan Presley and Sarah Jane Norman. As the Black Wave Initiative developed, two things became clear. First was the need to make space for discussion alongside the art being presented. And the second was the immense gratitude emerging Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander artists felt towards the generation that came before them, for the political struggles won, for the mentoring, the guidance and the instruction so generously given, for the insights into how to make the scene work for you. And I would say this intergenerational dialogue permeates well beyond the Indigenous artists in our program and is actually characteristic of a number of projects in the 2014 festival. So our special guest panellists tonight, and we're going to get to them really soon, they represent a very wide range of generations and of artistic practices. A number of these artists have created work that strongly influenced the emerging artists in our program, and their names are frequently mentioned in the book. It's a great privilege to have them with us, to share their ideas on the future of contemporary practice for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. So on behalf of all of Next Wave, I'd like to thank Arts Victoria, the Australia Council for the Arts, the City of Melbourne and the Beeson family for their support of our work. And without any more from me, I would now like to welcome my co-curator Taji Moa to the stage, Tony Albert, a member of Next Wave's Curatorial Advisory Committee, and Destiny Deacon, Virginia Fraser and Clinton Nain. And I'd now like to hand over to our host, Richard Bell.
First of all, I'd like to thank the people in Next Wave and Black Wave for inviting me here, you know, flying me down Qantas, you know, like, we're here to talk about these young fellas in this show, and we got this real deadly young black curator here, you know, like, who co-curated this thing. I'm going to ask her to tell us about some of the things here and why you think it's important.
Yeah, so I guess Black Wave, you know, essentially the publication looks at, you know, the emerging generation of Indigenous artists, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander artists, and how important your mentoring has been in our practice, and you know, looking to the future, what we're sort of looking to achieve in the future of Indigenous art. Yeah, I guess that's spiel.
Well, I was asked very early on to be involved with Megan Cope, and I had no idea that this thing evolved into this dynamic new thing, you know, called Black Wave. But look, it's so fantastic to see so many young blackfellas in a show and getting this kind of attention. You know, like when me and Destiny was slugging it out there in the 90s, it was very different. There wasn't an emerging art scene. You know, like, we basically had to jump up and down to get into shows. You know? And then they'd only put us into, you know, one at a time or two at a time, and then they put us in Darkie's Corner somewhere.
You know? Mr. Brisbane, I was lucky being a Melbourne girl. We had the Melbourne Fringe Festival, and me and three other Indigenous women,
I take it back.
We were in the Fringe Festival, and that was 1990.
Yeah, but that was on the Fringe too. So
yeah, and it was in Brunswick.
It's the festival equivalent of Darkie's Corner.
And I was a teacher in those days, and then I got in the Fringe Festival, and then the art started happening, and what have you. And before I knew it, I was an artist. But I took photography. We start like that, and then before you know it, you're doing shows and exhibiting in, you know, real galleries. And that was the first wave. I think Ricardo's trying to say we were sort of like the sort of first wave when we started. And it was not just in the visual arts, it was also in music and theatre and dance, films, theatre, of course. And I just want to say, you remember, I was the first one to use the word BLAK, and that was in the early 90s. And that's because white people... I grew up in Melbourne. I lived here since 1959. As a little toddler, and I haven't been anywhere since, and I love Melbourne.
It's a great place to visit.
Yes, yes. But my mum was black as the ace of spades, and Clinton's mum too. And I just remember in the 60s and stuff like that, people would just stop in the streets and just and look at her and point and things like that. And also growing up as little kids in Fitzroy, Brunswick and areas like that, and Port Melbourne, yeah, we'd always be called Black Seas and stuff. I won't talk rude. So I thought, I'll take the C out of black. And that's why it's B-L-A-K. The idea of B-L-A-K also was to do with about colonialism and to do with about how we can express ourselves as urban people that have put up with that kind of system. And we are sort of political. We've got something to say. And we also love where we come from and have family and have networks and stuff.
And who else wants something to say?
Defining a new language. I think that deserves a round of applause.
I'm sorry I never copyrighted it because Coca-Cola came out with it with B-L-A-K Coke. Imagine I could have made it some money. That'll be that day. Anyway, next.
She was put in her English teacher school.
Good teacher.
Yeah, I'm still teaching.
Can we get something from Tony?
Yes.
Hey, Tony.
Tony, tell us about your involvement in this project, and how this came to be.
Well, it's very early in the actually in the curatorial process of it, and actually picking the artist for Next Wave, and I was very, obviously very, very interested. I thought that's a really great project to be involved in. What I didn't know, they sent hundreds and hundreds of people apply for this thing, and you have to read every application and come forward. And there was what happens is there's standout, there's people you know you want in, there's people that are you don't think, and that middle group is the ones you challenge over. But I went into the meeting with people in mind that I went in believing in my heart that I'm going to have to fight for their involvement. I believed very heavily in their projects. And to my surprise, as the only Aboriginal person on the curatorium, that every other person picked those people that I had picked as well. And to be very honest, I went in almost aggressively because I was very sure that I'm going to have to fight for these people. So it's testament to those in Next Wave that transferred over to Black Wave, because I'm talking about people that were Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander, and I felt had a voice which not only needs to be heard, would be very important in the forum. The only other thing I'd say that with when the book came along and Taji's involvement, having come up through both Richard and Destiny for those, I was Richard's studio assistant for nearly 5 years. And
my teacher
deserves a medal.
Yeah. Hey, stop that. I resemble that.
What I guess you realise with even what Destiny was talking about, the forums within a performance, within art, within creative societies existed because it was the performers, it was the artists that were taking on those roles. Artists were becoming curators, not because they wanted to, but because if they didn't take the positions, no one else would. Mm-hmm. And what we have now is people like Taji, like Bruce McLean at the Queensland Art Gallery, Stephen Gilchrist, formerly of the NGA, that are going through universities, having an education in art history to take on these jobs. And it gives a chance for the artists to actually be artists. And we don't have to go and go, well, we need to be the curator, because then that's the only way we're going to get curated into shows. There is this younger generation taking on that role, which is incredibly exciting. So any chance I get to be involved in that kind of forum and very early on in that curatorium, I absolutely put my hand up and was very honoured to be involved.
Yeah, so Destiny, we didn't just open the doors, for these youngsters to come through, We kicked them off the fucking hinges.
Yes.
So, there's no doors there now. People can get picked into these shows now. And I was so surprised, pleasantly surprised, to see this this thing eventuate. It evolved, behind my back, basically. it emerged, and I'd think, damn, this is so good, you know, for these youngsters, you know, to have their words, you know, put into print, you know. What you got to realise is that they're there forever. So make sure when you're giving talks and that, you know, to think carefully about what you say and that. You know, me, I don't care what they write about me. Just as long as they keep writing about me, that's awesome.
Yeah, and then the process or the way in which we think about it, I have great non-Aboriginal friends who are curators that always have an Aboriginal person in their show, but it's not to tick a box, it's not tokenistic. It's because the belief that how can you curate a show under any premise within an Australian context without having an Aboriginal person in it, without having a woman in it. You have failed before you started if that is not mixed. And it's this double-edged sword. It's this idea that you're having someone in, but not because you need them in it, it's because they have to be in it. And whether what the percentage is, it does, if it's one, if it's the majority of the show.
Yeah, but that's what we were telling them too ages ago.
This audience is testament to that, though, as well. I mean, I think
we were fantastic, mate.
10 years ago. you know, 10 years ago, there would not have been this, you know, you'd be flat out getting this amount of only black people into to come and listen to you.
Your family.
Well, you know, to
what are you saying there?
Well, in terms of an art context, anyway, so that people, they want to hear, they want to learn, they want to know, and this publication, I think the way it has those spare pages within it, you can take notes, you can listen, start your own language, but there might have been this apprehensive nature about the inclusion of Aboriginal people in things that I think people are far more open to or know that there is something wrong. And there definitely is something wrong and it needs to change. And there is a sophistication that is here now that it's not saying that it didn't exist before, but it might be easier to converse in a way. I'm not sure if that's true or not, but I think it's happening.
Well, I'm living in Queensland. You know,
I moved.
Thank goodness.
It's quite. Hey, stop that.
I love the teeth, Ricardo. But one thing also is that a lot of Indigenous people around Australia are going to bloody art school now, which is unlike us two, Rhodes Scholars. And and they're studying people like us too, remember?
You didn't have to go to uni, or
I'm just saying.
It's very different.
I went to uni though and stuff, but I studied politics and history.
I went to stuff that was useful, you know, like accounting and economics and law. Yes.
And then there's university degrees which myself went through, but I know Richard, you're an advocate for its inception, that the Bachelor of Visual Arts majoring in Contemporary Australian Indigenous Art, the only university accredited degree for art that is only for Aboriginal people, and have had graduates, Vernon Archie.
Yeah, yourself, Andrea Fisher, Ryan Presley, who's in this show.
I know when I was graduated, I was the only student. The one student left, we started with about 8 in the class, but comparatively to a university degree which maybe starts with 300, 400 students and only 100 graduate, that's kind of, you know, comparatively similar, that, you know, it is hard, it is tough, it does sort out the people who want to be there to who don't, but...
My brother Clinton went to the VCA and then COFA.
I went to VCA back in the early 90s and I was apparently the second Aboriginal person to walk in the door. The person happened to be before me was Kylie Ballin that graduated from the drama department, and then I graduated from the School of Fine Arts at VCA in 95. And
it was a big deal for a boy from Lilo.
So it's sort of... affiliated and then amalgamated with Melbourne University just as I graduated. So I ended up with a certificate, Bachelor of Arts and Fine Arts from Melbourne University. Yeah, so that was an achievement after, I think, When I did graduate, it was 150 years of the school existing here.
But they could never understand what you were painting, hey, because they thought, you know...
Well, they actually, questioned why was I doing that and Indigenous what was the relevance and you don't have to do that and, you know, paint flowers and what have you and bowls of fruit and naked people or something, I don't know. But because I was painting, you know, things that were to do with story and politics and my family history and all that kind of thing, and I guess that didn't understand it because they're white people and they don't understand my culture and my history. They didn't know at that time. I guess things have changed since then, hopefully. But like I know that there's a lot more. Well, there's lots of people who have graduated since then, Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander people from that college in particular. But
that's because we demanded those changes. You know, like back then, you know, like we wanted the institutions to take notice of what we were doing. We were looking at them and seeing that they weren't putting Aboriginal people into shows. And we were saying, how can you not put Aboriginal people into shows? You
know, we had Blackness, Black City Culture at the Contemporary Arts Centre in Alice Brooks Drive, across the road from VCA.
Australian Centre of Contemporary Arts. Yeah. It was in St Kilda Road. It was an old house.
And that was like one of the biggest like contemporary black exhibitions here in Melbourne.
That was the first one. Claire Williamson. Yeah.
Yeah, curated and Hedy Perkins.
And Hedy Perkins. And that's where Blackness came from because they wanted a name. And bang, the old teacher. And take the C out of it.
By the time I got to the VCA about 5 years later, when I did an MA, a self-administered MA, that had sort of reversed. And so everybody in that course was really, they're very interested. When people write their exegesis of their work, it was all about, supposed to be spilling your guts kind of autobiography. And so perhaps you had an influence on the way they did it, because obviously they resisted your autobiography and yet they are forcing it on people 5 years later.
Well, things changed dramatically, for the good. Because when I was there, they were still like teaching Aboriginal people who were primitive and Stone Age and all this kind of thing. I had to actually get up out of the class.
They expected me to draw dots.
And went to Melbourne University to the liaison office there in Faraday Street to Lisa Belair at the time. And I said to her, I don't know if I can handle this because they're still telling us or teaching, you know, us that Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander people are primitive and, you know, we don't have the culture, we're not artists or, you know, all that kind of thing. And I was in tears. I caught the tram from Swanson Street down from VCA up to Melbourne Uni, and Lisa grabbed me by the hand and took me straight to the Vice-Chancellor, and I told him. Well, the next thing you know, he's come down on the college there and made him change all their curriculum and made him do cultural awareness programs and all this kind of thing happened.
Oh, too deadly.
And, it was a hard road,
That's a wave.
You know, it does make it easier and easier, and those simple things, like what you might not realise is that people like yourselves going to the library and saying, oh, could you get this book in, and things like that, that gave us much better resources when we came along. So,
I guess, you know, we believed, like, you know, we believed in what we were doing. We believed in being educated. We believed in our people, our culture, our history, and our story, and we wanted to tell that from our point of view and make it ourselves, regardless whether it's for, you know, myself personally or for my family or for the community or for the world or whatever, you know. But it was basically doing it for ourselves and not being told what to do, but actually doing it and showing them what we can do, what we're capable of and what we want to do. And we were changing that gradually,
Taji, can you tell us a bit about some of the artworks in Black Wave?
Yes. Black Wave is a very diverse exhibition of works. So there are performance works and visual works, in the sort of visual arts realm. And I guess, there are some really sort of confronting works You know, they're really unpredictable. You know, looking at issues of identity, I see that as a particularly strong theme, and you know, looking back at Australian history and themes that really, you know, think make Australian audiences think about things, you know, how they wouldn't normally think about them.
Well, that's what we're always doing. We're educating.
Yeah, always, yeah.
As artists, we're the educators of, you know, the world, of the community, our families, and that's what we do.
Like some of the issues, you know, like are going to be, and the artworks are going to be challenging for both black fellas and white fellas, you know. So I think that's probably the mark of a good work, you know, if it's going to challenge, you know, both sides of an argument or a discussion, you know, people will be challenged, you know, will be emotionally challenged.
And the challenge is good. Like, when I can think about, you know, making work back at, like, VCA's days or the Black City, Blackness, Black City Culture exhibition and all of that, that kind of, and I know Destiny and the other artists, it made us think a lot more in depth of what we really want to achieve, what we want to say. And I think it was scary because for the first time we're putting out our deeper, you know, inner thoughts about our blackness and what we really think, and, you know, the politics of it all, and radical and angry or whatever, or sad or in love or whatever it is, happy.
And being naughty.
And naughty and all of those things. And it was a great opportunity. I can remember that freedom. All of a sudden, there was this amazing feeling of a freedom to express yourself. Finally, without anyone telling you not to do that or you can't do that. And that alone was a great empowerment, I think. And from that, those days and stuff, that we have artists here that are still doing that. And I see, seeing that over the years growing and becoming stronger and stronger, it's an amazing thing to witness, to know how little we actually had. And the artists that... the beautiful artists that we had back, you know, 20, 30 years ago producing work, yeah, it was hard for them to, I guess, have a place to actually exhibit their work and to be seen and be heard and actually be taken seriously and understood and not to be, you know, whatever, the audience feeling intimidated or... you know, like scared of the black people or the natives getting restless, you know, and they're getting angry with the artists, they're getting angry and all that kind of thing. So things have changed, and now we can sit here and talk openly and things like that and not feel persecuted, you know, and all of those things that come along with being different and standing up for your difference.
You're listening to Away on RN, and I'm Rhianna Patrick. That was Clinton Nain speaking at the Black Wave Festival in Melbourne. Clinton was part of a panel discussion about the generational changes Indigenous artists are experiencing. Also on the panel, Clinton's big sister, the highly respected artist Destiny Deacon. I'll hand you back to her.
And another thing you've got to realise, that a lot of our artists are very fragile. Hey, Richard, we've seen so many come and go and die. Yes. Since 1990, so many beautiful artists, man, woman, from all different regions and urban areas, say, and the best of friends and everything going for them, and then bang, they're gone. Just sort of, it's a really fragile community with the art stuff as well.
Yeah, well, you have a look at the government now wants to raise the retirement age to 70. You know, like the life expectancy of an Aboriginal man
doing
is 69.1.
Well,
you know, so we're never going to get to retire.
Keep working.
Yeah, and it's a universal thing, especially what's happening with our people too. It's to do with poverty, it's to do with homelessness, education, all these sort of things. And there's so many issues.
Racism.
That's still the biggie. I can't believe it. There's still such a big issue in Australia. It's the most racist country in the world. Everyone reckons that.
You know, that's why I think, you know, Indigenous artists have such an important role, because you are, you know, telling people these histories. You know, I went through school and I didn't really learn that much about Aboriginal history. You know, everything I've learnt about Indigenous culture has been from, you know, looking at art and, you know, learning from people like you, well, everyone on this panel. You've been my history teachers.
Well, good luck to you.
Man, we're just making... me and my friends, we're just making art about our lives. You know, they're very autobiographical, the works that we make. So these are very much, you know, like personal histories. You know, like, and we are the primary sources, you know, like in a lot of cases, for what has happened. So, you know, we're witnesses to what has happened to us, in, you know, like in this short period of time in this country. I remember things being much tougher than what they are now, but I'm pretty chuffed that this thing has emerged. You know, like these young people, you know, a lot of whom we've had, you know, a lot to do with and influence. I've got one here who learned from us. I find real great solace in that.
Question time. Boss, question time.
Just on that note of passing down your histories, do you feel that as artists you have much of a dialogue between generations? Does it extend past state lines? How do you communicate between artists and between aesthetics?
Oh, well, it's not by fax or email much. You know, like it's still conversation, you know, pretty much.
If you make art, you've got to... what I do is you've got to... Yeah, what's happening now in life and stuff like that, but also reading, being informed and coming up with an issue or something that concerns you and stuff. And it's, look, with our people, gosh, where do you start? But also it's how you feel at the time and just being true to yourself and stuff and just coming up with something where you can make some work.
Yeah,
and how you're going to deal with it. It's a real big process. But also, I don't know, you've got to do something that's not embarrassing to do with your people as well. Mm. You know, you don't shame anybody, especially yourself too, and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, it's a small pool that age doesn't exist. Gender maybe once doesn't exist. I've spent next to, you know, half my life with Richard, and then when people, you know, say, oh, you know, oh, he's really homophobic, I kind of think, well, gee, I don't, you know, that's not my experience.
So I'm a recovering homophobe. Get it right.
But to take on what we're doing, we cannot be misogynist. We cannot be against what is happening, you know, to people who are trying to enter this country and the awful ways that we treat them. Like, we cannot stand up for what we believe and our issues without supporting those as well. And that's become the framework in a dialogue which Destiny brought up earlier, extends beyond Aboriginality. It's actually a human condition, and, you know, we have to support each other.
Yes, we're on about equality, you know, like, you know, for everybody, you know, like, not just black fellas, you know, like, it's for, you know, women, you know, like, in actual fact, women are the biggest population in the world, you know, their oppression is the biggest issue, you know, like, on the planet.
Yep.
So, you know, like, for us to be fighting for black fellas' rights and not to be fighting for women's rights, not to be fighting for gay rights, is just hypocritical. So, you know, we can't expect to get any kind of credibility unless we support those
and
those other causes.
We have to think like that, and we have to be mindful of that. I went to the Volgari Art Award last night and supported my brother Daniel Boyd, and an amazing achievement. Thank you.
Go Dan.
But he was the third recipient of that award and the third male to win that award. So, in my mindset and thinking the way we do that. Our society is more willing to put a black man forward than a woman forward. So, you know, that is how I think. That is what I think when I'm there. And I'm congratulatory, and I'm so glad that he won it. And that's a massive step forward to us. But they've committed to another 3 years, so I'd like to see the next three awards go to females.
Yeah. Next question.
This has been incredibly inspiring. I think it's just fantastic hearing everyone's comments and stories. And I'm just wondering, what's the hope of young Australians, first Australians and Australians, hearing something like this. I think it's just what the young people need to hear, to have this inspiration and to be encouraged by your comments and your stories. And thank you very much.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'd like to think that I'm a pretty, you know, optimistic person, and you know, I think that we are progressing, and you know, things are getting a lot better. And you know, as we were talking about how, you know, the generations before us, you know, how you fought so hard to, you know, achieve visibility for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, and just made those little changes so, you know, we can, you know, enjoy what we have today and things like that. So,
you know, education is super. I always maintain, you know, the greatest gift we can give our children is historical truth. We have a great deal of pain to go through as a country by acknowledging what has really happened here and what other cultures or religions overseas have taught us. That comes with a great deal of pain for us all to deal with. But that acknowledgement has to happen first. I think earlier I said that the involvement of Aboriginal people, not as ticking the box, but as valid voices within a critical dialogue, is super important. And I would also really love to see greater collaborations between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people. Not non-Aboriginal people taking and using Aboriginal imagery for their own gain, but actually working together on under, you know, there's a visual language that we can create as a society, which is so important. And when I look at those people's works that appropriate Aboriginal art, the thing that I love about them is what is that it exists, that dialogue needs to exist, but the tragedy is there's no cohesiveness, there's no, again, it's about taking ownership over something, not being part of something. And yeah, that's you know, something that I think I would love to see.
There's a kind of creepy stalker thing, seems to me, in the sort of appropriation you're talking about, where people follow around and just like copying your hairstyle. Yeah.
I mean, I should be apologetic. The most significant and people we should be looking at as yourself and Destiny, Virginia, that, you know, you really were at the forefront of that, created around a dialogue, around talking to each other, about mutual respect, about, you know, something that wasn't about someone taking from someone else. It was this idea that stemmed through. This should be happening, and that should be happening in Australia.
So there you got it. You know, like, we got the young people, you know, saying to these artists out here, appropriating inappropriately. You know, like, stop trying to, you know, collect a pet abo. Oops, did I say Aborigine?
But I think, yeah, over the past, when I've collaborated with non-Indigenous people and worked with them, it is such an empowerment. It's like, again, a freedom that you can express, and if you share something that you kind of don't have that every day of your life, like walking down the street or whatever you're doing, but it's sort of, when you do come across that and involve yourself in that situation and you're communicating on that level, you're both like hummingbirds, you know, and you're creating, and there's this energy, and you're firing off each other. And when those times did come along, and I was part of those things, that I've never really felt anything like that doing anything else. You know, there's something about it that, yeah.
That's not a very common occurrence. You know, like the power structure, the power dialogue between black fellas and white fellas is generally, you know, the white fella having the power, and that's what's been problematic with
I felt empowered all of a sudden. I was telling the white person what to do and what to wear and where to stand and all of that kind of thing. But sometimes they didn't have to, because they were in tune, like they knew what I was talking about, and they knew from their own life experience, from their own history. You know, when you come across somebody like that, when you can work with somebody like that in performance, for instance, it's magical.
Who's this next question?
Me. Hi. I'm Paola, and I'm a Victorian Aboriginal woman artist. And it's more of a comment, because I actually want to thank Destiny and Clinton And no disrespect to Tony and Richard, because I really love your work as well. But having arrived in Melbourne as an 18-year-old from Yorta Yorta country in Echuca to go to Melbourne Uni in 1993, Destiny was one of my tutors.
I was teaching you English literature at Melbourne Uni. Because you wagged a lot of classes, I remember that.
And the reason
she was in the Clyde Hotel.
I was in the Clyde and PAs and the Courier unit at Faraday Street and the other one down from the pub. But the reason I did a BA is because when I was at high school, all I ever wanted to be was an artist. My grandmother was an artist.
Well, you're supposed to read the book. You only have to read one Australian novel a week.
I know, but
so did I.
It's because
it killed you.
It's because I wanted to study art, but I never thought I was good enough, so I didn't go to art school. But 14 years later, I am a practicing artist. And in 2000, Next Wave did a really great show called Abnormal, and it was curated by Gail Harradine and Daniel King. Yeah. And it was myself and Clinton and Mandy Nicholson and Craig Charles and people like that. And so Next Wave gave me an opportunity 14 years ago, so I want to say thank you for that. And I really want to thank Destiny and Clinton, because you were my role models growing up when I got here. You showed me that black political landscape of Melbourne that is invisible to a lot of other people, but you showed me the way, and I really appreciate that.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Val.
Sadly, we've come to the end of this night. Thank you very much once again for the invitation, and thank you, panellists. And thank you.
Big round of applause. It's amazing.
Richard Bell being thanked by Artistic Director of Next Wave, Emily Sexton. Alongside Richard on today's panel were Destiny Deacon, Clinton Nain, Virginia Fraser, Tony Albert and Taji Moore. All the details are on our page at the Radio National website, abc.net.au/Radio National, and go to Away at the top of the drop-down box. You can listen online, download a copy, or leave us a comment as well. I'm Rhianna Patrick. This is Away on RN. When Ben Gratz joined the Emerging Indigenous Producer Mentorship Program at the Darwin Entertainment Centre last June, his role was to encourage people to get involved in the arts. But during that short space of time, Ben created the Garmalung Festival, a first for Darwin in the Northern Territory. Taking place over 3 days, the inaugural festival features the likes of Archie Roach and Tom E. Lewis. Away's Rico Adrin spoke to Ben Gratz.
First up, Ben. Last year, June, you joined the Entertainment Centre. In that time, here's Garmalung Festival.
Yeah, exactly. So from June last year, which isn't that long ago, to now, amongst the other projects that I've been working on, this main project, the festival, is something that's really exciting and, you know, has happened very quickly. But because of that, I think it's made it quite excitable, and there's a lot of interest around it. And I think it's time to have this festival.
Getting the Larrakia involved was your number one priority when we spoke last year.
Absolutely. You know, because in Darwin, this is the home of the Larrakia people, and I wanted to pay respects to that. I wanted to make sure that they had an involvement with it. And, you know, I'm really proud to say that two of our headlining acts are Larrakia people. And also we have a whole exhibition of Larrakia artwork that's going to be throughout the foyer of the Darwin Entertainment Centre. And we have a very special and unique welcome ceremony that's going to be conducted by the Larrakia people as well.
Well, why was this festival so important?
Well, there's a lot of reasons, I believe, but the main reason is a celebration of who we are as Indigenous people, and particularly up here in the Northern Territory. We're such a diverse community, we're such a multicultural community, and I think sometimes the Larrakia people amongst that get forgotten, and I really wanted to showcase them. I really wanted to showcase all the other Indigenous people that make up the Darwin region and the Top End region. And also, you know, sharing with our national brothers and sisters as well.
Could you touch on the Larrakia mob as a people and how they're faring?
I've just moved back to Darwin in the last 5 years. And before that, I was a young teenager, you know, with ambition in my eyes and wanting to travel the world. And that's what I did. And so, you know, and I particularly didn't know a lot about my culture and a lot about my people. And I learned that in my travels while being away. And so coming back to Darwin and seeing the different cultures around the world, not just in Australia, but also particularly in the Northern Territory and working in remote communities, working in other communities in the rest of Australia, it was really interesting for me to come back and go, there really isn't a, the Larrakia people, I couldn't really, there wasn't a sense of who they were in this city. And, you know, like there wasn't a presence, I suppose. And so a part of this festival for me was about going, well, that presence needs to be there, because as we know, the Larrakia people have always been here and always will be here. Mm. And there's a lot of culture and there's a lot of stories and there's a lot of families that make up the Larrakia people. And, you know, I think for me, what I wanted to do was make a platform. We're not only showcasing, like I said, and showcasing is probably not the right word, but giving the opportunity for the Larrakia people to really, you know, be seen and showcase what they have in terms of the artwork and the songs and the dances. All of those things was really important to me.
Garamalung, first of its kind?
Yes. Look, as far as I know and as far as everyone else that keeps talking to me has said, is that there has never been an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander festival of this size held in Darwin before, particularly as a part of the Darwin Entertainment Centre. I can tell you right now that's never happened. So that's a first as well. So, you know, look, I left here, like I said, when I was 16 and went and pursued the arts, and I come back, I'm 37 now. And for in that time, for that not to have happened is really, that's really interesting to me. I kind of go, why has that not happened? Why have we not seen an Indigenous culture in this city before? You know, we have them in every other capital city, most of the other capital cities, but to not have it in Darwin, where Indigenous people make up 30% of the population of the Northern Territory, something's not right there.
And when a festival is enabled or created for a people, it can only be empowering.
Absolutely, you know, and as all festivals are, as anything is, you know, this is the first year, so there's going to be, you know, there's going to be problems and there's going to be, you know, things that are going to be amazing and things that are going to be not so good. But, you know, for me, this festival, and particularly this year, is just about making it happen and getting it out there, getting the word out there and setting it up so in future years, when it happens every year in May, that there's a solid foundation and we just keep building on that each year, you know. And so that's my passion at the moment, is making sure that this year just happens. And I think we have an incredible, you know, like I'm really proud of the shows that we've managed to program. As you mentioned before, in such a short time, so this is from June last year, we've got Archie Roach, we've got Tommy Lewis doing his album launch, Darwin album launch. We have Gary Lang, NT Dance Company, premiering their new work, Mukoi. The Chuki Mala, Chuki Dancers are back, and they're at the moment, you know, like just performing to sell out houses around Australia. And not to mention, you know, Ali Mills, the local Larrakia woman, and the cheeky Miscellaneous and Constantina Bush. You can never forget them.
You're a producer, performer, all that. Have you worked on something on this sort of scale before?
Kind of. Like it's, I think throughout my career I've worked, I've dabbled in a lot of the areas that are required for a festival, and I've worked on the Darwin Festival.
Yeah.
I was the artistic director on the Pride Festival. I've worked on the Sydney Olympics with Stephen Page. So I've been around it. I understand it. But this is really bringing all of my skills together in one go, particularly because I'm not only, you know, the artistic director, but I'm the creative producer. I'm also, like I said, producing works. And also, I'm performing. So, you know, it's all of my skills rolled into one. So that's a bit overwhelming, but also exciting.
Tell us about the search for a name for the festival.
Yeah, well, that really came from the Larrakia. And I heard through a friend that that was the word for the Darwin region, and the Larrakia word for the Darwin region. And I was like, that's interesting. And so then I went to Larrakia Nation and went through the formal procedure of asking for permission for that word, because that's really important to me, because I'm just not going to misappropriate, and I need to make sure that it's coming from the right place.
Yeah.
And so that was really a 2-month process in terms of getting the permission to use that name. And that's really important to me. One, it's important to make sure culturally we're doing that correctly. And then also we're exposing people to a language and to a word that they might not have heard before. And, you know, it's all about that cultural maintenance and, you know, the education. And I think that's vitally important.
Tell us about the word Garamalang.
Garamalang, well, it's the Larrakia word for the Darwin region. So basically it's, and that was in, it's where the festival is. It's the area of Darwin. And I think it kind of sounds nice. that's always important when you're creating a title for a festival, a brand for a festival. Yeah, so, you know, like, I think that was important for me.
Could you briefly touch on the festivals in general within the NT, what's currently on offer, and how Garamalang will stand out?
Yeah, look, there's festivals. There's quite a lot of festivals that happen throughout the Northern Territory, and particularly Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander festivals. This focus was very much on Darwin and the top end, and really it was about a metropolitan festival that celebrates the people that live here, the Larrakia people that live here, and also the other communities that make up the Darwin region, really. And then the other reason why I am keen to have it at the start of the dry season and at the start of May is that it will kick off all of the other regional and remote festivals that happen, in particular Barunga, Beswick, Walking with the Spirits, so on and so on and so on. And Merripin, sorry, I forgot to mention Merripin. And that's really important, because what we establish here in Darwin, we can support and share the resources for the rest of those other festivals. So it's about all of us working together and going, you know, let's create this festival up in Darwin because it's not happening, but let's also do it so we can share and support each other for the rest of the festivals that come afterwards.
There can never be too many festivals, perhaps an oversaturation?
Well, the answer is yes. But also I think that because, as we've mentioned, this has never happened before, so there's a need for this festival. And I think each festival that does happen in the Northern Territory and also in Darwin, they're unique. They're all unique. And I think that's what's important. I think if we had two Indigenous cultural festivals that had similar kind of visions and statements, I think that's detrimental. But because we have such a unique presence and each festival is so different, I think that it's fine. And festivals are great because you're able to experience a lot of stuff in a small amount of time.
That's Ben Gratz, Artistic Director of the inaugural Garamalang Festival. It was a great lineup, and you can find a link on the Away website. And you'll hear all the action from the festival over the coming weeks. Don't forget, you can leave a comment. We always like to hear from you. You can listen online or podcast the program. Next week, Jintu Desert Band discusses their new album, and Clancestry looks at the forgotten frontier wars with Professor Henry Reynolds. Well, that's our program. Thanks for joining me. I'm Rhianna Patrick. Thanks also to my co-producer, Rico Adrin, Away EP, Lorena Allam, and our sound engineer, Jim Usher. Away is on your radio Saturdays at 6 and every Tuesday night at 9. But for now, enjoy your evening here on RN.
This is titled The Genetics of Regret. I'm sorry I don't call. Sorry I lied about acid and the boy with the knife, the house full of beer rats. Sorry for the weevils and the dead grass. I'm sorry I don't call anymore.
Owning your own white guilt isn't cool yet. So you stuff the soft parts of other kids' cultures into your pockets until you believe it is not there.
Hip-hop, identity politics, and urban culture. New York City poets. You can stream Poetica from the RN website.